Okay, once again, it's Bob and Cameron, and this is our 24th episode, being recorded on April 29th, 2021. And in our last episode, which was a marvelous episode, at the end, I was making some comments, wrap-up comments, and Cameron could hear me, but I couldn't hear him. So he was sort of responding, but I didn't hear it. So he gave up and hung up, and then I gave up and hung up. So it was an aborted ending. And what I was saying to Cameron that I didn't think he heard, talking about this third position, neither acoustic or visual space, this tactile space in between, I said, it's like McLuhan talked about the Zen interval. And then I mentioned the golden section. Then I was trying to think of something else, so I looked up the quotes later, and he talks about at the beginning of this sequence of sentences, which is like his essence of his epiphany, he says, the East has the integrity of the interval, and the West has the integrity of the object, and oral culture resolves the split between East and West. East being the integrity of the interval, and the West being the integrity of the object. So I
Where is this from, Bob? I didn't hear where you said...
It's Hot and Cool. And it's page 108 of the hardback. Before you go over to 109, which you were laughing at me remembering the precise page last week, and at the top of 109, he talks about the dynamic symmetry of tensions among proportions yields the golden section in space.
And what's the section of Hot and Cool that this is in? Is this one of the introductory sections?
No, it's well into the book, and there's been essays by other people, and then he went back to quoting early McLuhan. And so he would do that. He would do early McLuhan, then there'd be some more essays by people, and then maybe early 60s McLuhan, and then it ends with a long interview, which was his up-to-date statement. But,
but when I said introductory material, what I meant was The Hot and Cool is divided into different sections, like you just indicated. But there's usually an introductory portion of those sections. And I think I don't have Hot and Cool in front of me, but I think you're quoting from one of the introductory parts of one of the sections.
Yes, it's probably the second section. But it starts with that statement with the integrity of the East and West will be resolved in oral culture. And I was talking to some people about this, and I said, actually, I mentioned you, I said, Cameron feels that by the late 50s, he would say it got resolved in tactile culture. So that
I think that's true. The use of tactile... he used the word tactile and tactility fairly early, but he didn't come to use it as a name for the interval until sometime in the 60s, I believe. But you're absolutely right that around 1960, he was starting to correlate the type of relation between the subject and the object and the nature of the object.
Yes.
Right? And that's what people need to understand is that when the relation changes, so do the subject and the object. So it's the signature of the Gutenberg galaxy is the attempt to hold either the subject or the object constant, and to define everything else in the world in terms of one or the other.
Yes.
And So the significant move is to realize that the relationship between subject and object is prior to both of those. And so the third position arises when the when a person releases him or herself from fixation on either the subject or the object and goes over to the third position defined by tactility.
Yeah, perfect. And so I cited that because we're wrapping up and talking about the achieving parity on the tactility point, getting on the same page more than we had or I had been before. So then I brought up the phrase magic casements of being. And
right.
I wanted to see what you thought of that. I like that phrase. Does uh-huh. that casement, does that mean window?
Yes.
Yeah,
and
magic.
He uses,
go ahead.
Well, he that phrase, I forget exactly which essay it's in, but he uses that phrase in the early 1950s.
Yeah, I think it's in the 1954 famous one, Catholic Humanism.
Mm-hmm. Could be.
I think it's in there.
Mm-hmm.
So the magic casements of being, the magic windows on being of being. He says in the sequence that leads up to the Golden Section statement on 108 and 109, he says it leads to the intuition of being, the epiphany and revelation, he says in the previous sentences. And that's interesting. It includes the tactile version of being or the non-object of being or the it's only an intuition of being. You don't know if you're being.
I don't think that's what he's saying there. I think what he's saying is that when you realize a different relationship to the world, where the world informs you instead of you trying to inform the world, then you intuit being in the sense of you have an immediate relationship to its reality.
Okay. Yeah, because before that, he talks about the importance of Hopkins, Gerard Manley Hopkins' sprung rhythm.
That's exactly.
That's before. You have an epiphany, or he talks about the epiphany or revelation, then the sprung rhythm.
All of this talk is about changing the relationship to, I don't even know the right word, let's say to the object or to what confronts you. But what happens with the change relationship is that that object changes, and at the very instant that that object changes, so does the subject.
Yes.
So it's the realization of the third position. So the reason it's epiphany is that the whole world changes.
Right. I noticed that Croker uses the words interpellate, P-E-L-L-A-T-E. Do you know what that means, offhand?
Well, pellation means to touch. So interpellation means inner communication.
And that's what you're describing. The object and subject relationship, they're both changed or change each other. That's interpellation, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So
it could be called that. It's not a everyday word.
No.
One would have to find out why he wanted to go to a technical word like that.
Right. Yeah, so he has interpellate. I remember looking it up knowing the meaning.
I think it's a medical word. I believe that different procedures done by doctors have to do with palliation.
Right. Okay, so, yeah, I remember years ago looking it up. Then I forgot, and then I saw it recently. I said, okay, didn't look it up, so I'm asking you, and you're saying, yes, it's the meaning I thought it meant.
Thinking about it, it probably is etymologically related to the word feel, right? Because P words in Latin and Greek become F words in Germanic languages. So, for example, fire becomes pyre in Greek, right?
Right.
And or father becomes pater There's many, many, many examples. Poor in Italian is four in English, on and on and on.
Right, and that's foot, you said that was peel becomes peel.
Yeah, or pellation, pell.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so did you want to talk about what you mentioned before we start recording now, or we'll go to get into that later?
Well, we are recording now, right?
Yes. But
yeah. So, I think what I'd like to say is important for an understanding of the tech body, because it seems to me that your idea about the tech body is that it's negative, and that one of the peculiar things about it is that although it's negative, it has a lot of things to say that are true and
yeah.
that are penetrating. And so I want to put forward the idea that we shouldn't decide in advance if the tech body is positive or negative. I think it could well turn out that the tech body either is not entirely negative or is not negative at all.
No, and I would agree with you. So we haven't determined what the tech, Ian says, we haven't determined what the tech body is going to do. Right now, Ian says it is trying to take people's power. It wants to get as much power as possible. But Ian has said in other points that our relationship to technology will be more intimate, friendly, or not classified as negative. So definitely what mm-hmm. you just said, Ian has said about the tech body.
Okay.
But when I talk to people about it, and then I say Ion is different from the tech body, I usually put a positive spin on Ion and a bit negative from tech body, because Ion's mm-hmm. not trying to take away people's power. So
right.
I get stuck
maybe,
in there. Words undermine me, but I'm ready to correct it if you notice uh-huh. it, which you did.
But what you call taking away the power in an important sense is a giving away of the power.
That's what Ion means. Like the Jews gave their power to the Ark of the Covenant, and nowadays people are giving their power to the Black Mirror.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's the tech body. So we're
that's
giving
right.
the power, and the tech body enjoys getting the power.
Correct, correct. But what's interesting about what we're doing here is that we're going into that black power.
Yeah.
The only way for people to change their position, to go from what might be called position one or position two into position three, is to interrogate the black power. So you
yeah, you're
go,
saying
you
power. T is in Tom.
No, power is
T is in P. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, and that.
That's what we call the nothingness we were saying last week.
Correct. Correct. So you have to go. You have to go through the interval, which appears only negative, in order to realize that the interval is in fact what enables who you are and what the world is.
So it's not negative.
Absolutely not. But the incredible thing about thinking is that what seems most hopeless, what seems most dark, what seems most stupid turns out to be the key to where you need to go.
Yes. Now, how does fear relate to that black power?
Well, fear is correlate with a certain sense of identity and with a certain sense of world. So when people are sort of on the cusp of thinking, death seems like a terrible thing.
Yeah.
It seems like the only certainty we have is death, and it's feared. But that is the mirror that needs to be gone through. It's a representation of death. It's not death itself.
Right. So the That's when you're stuck with an incomplete understanding of the subject-object relationships. That's what you were just describing. You'll be limited about yourself or confused, and limited and confused about the world, the object.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And you're desperately trying to swim in that water, and so you're grabbing at whatever little fragments of flotsam and jetsam are around you, and that doesn't work. What you need to do is you need to realize that the water is what buoys you up.
Yes.
Not some piece of wood that happens to be around.
Right. So, do you agree with Krishnamurti that the path to truth is individual or pathless? He said there's no one path.
Correct.
That's an old cliche, but
sure.
You wouldn't say how to go into that nothing.
No.
Right.
No, because every path is a representation that comes from the rearview mirror.
Yeah. So we are trying to prompt. Are we trying to prompt people to fall into the nothing, to go through the vanishing point?
Well, we're trying to prompt them into a questioning of what they think they can rely on. And that's a fearsome process, but it's the only door into the third position.
And Eric's definition of Manipian satire as an attempt to wake people is the same situation, to trick them into.
Well, sort of. I'm not a big fan of that whole topic, because I believe McLuhan sort of grabbed onto Manipian satire as a way of excusing the fact that he didn't correct his work, or that he repeated himself, or that
in the 70s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or that he told old jokes instead of making up a fresh lecture or something like that. So Manipian satire can be used to cover sins.
Yes.
And so I'm suspicious of it. I agree with Eric that McLuhan made attempts to overturn what people thought they saw, thought they believed, thought who they were. But to allow that to sort of cover everything he was doing in the 70s, I think that's not right.
Right. Now, do you know the distinction that Don Thiel makes between Manipian satire and Veronian satire?
Mm-mm. No, I don't.
Okay, so Varro lived at the time of Christ, back there around then, and he discovered the texts of Menippus. And Menippus was outrageous, and he lived about 220 B.C., was it B.C.E.? And what he did with that was outrageous, is he mixed poetry and prose. They were meant to be separate, but he mixed them together. It was outrageous in the early phonetic days, you know, the early writing in Greek culture. So he mixed his media, is what McLuhan would say later. So anyways, the definition of Manipian satire in the 20th century, if you look it up, is basically making fun of philosophers. You know, having philosophers pontificate and then making them look absurd. That's the standard interpretation of Manipian satire. But what happened is that Varro discovers Manippus. I don't know what Varro called it. I don't know if he used the term Manipian. I haven't read anything by him on that level. But what happened in the Dark Ages, it all disappeared. And John Dryden, the British poet, he was a poet, right?
Mm-hmm.
Poet and essayist.
Yep.
He discovered Varro, recognized it was a different satire from Horace or Juvenal. They were more satires of public figures or human foibles. So he because he discovered it through Varro, he called it Varronian satire. So Varronian satire held for a couple of hundred years until Bakhtin, B-A-K-H-T-I-N, the Russian critic, in the 30s, 40s, 50s, whenever he wrote his books, he wrote on Rabelais, and he retrieved the word Menippean satire. He retrieved Menippean. And then Julia Kristeva did a book in the late 60s, Desire in Language, you know, responding to Bakhtin, that Bakhtin influenced her in some way. And so she popularized Menippean satire. Now, nobody knew that McLuhan knew the term Menippean satire for some reason in the 50s, or Don Thiel would say he did, because Don Thiel uses the term Menippean satire in his 1971 book, The Medium is a Rearview Mirror, talking about Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. That, when I read that book around 71, 72, that's when I first saw the term Menippean. Then I was with Eric around 75, and he mentioned to me that his father was a Menippean satirist. So I started to look into it, but it wasn't until I read Eric's PhD, the one that was at the Ann Arbor repository, because his book of 1997, The Role of Thunder in Phoenix Wake, has a very short section on Menippean satire, and the rest of the book is dealing with the Ten Thunders of Phoenix Wake. But his PhD has a long section on the history of Menippean satire and how it was defined. And Eric's main point was you can't take one description of Menippean satire, one definition, which is what was circulating in criticism in the 20th century, because new technologies change society, and a Menippean satire is always a response to the changing effects in the medium. So the Menippean satires from, say, some guy in 400 A.D., and then 1200 A.D., Alan of Lille, L-I-L-L-E, is one of those guys in there, and then Rabelais in the 16th century. So these major technological phases, which he noticed was every 400 years, you'd get a different kind of a cynical, based on the philosophy of cynicism traditionally, a cynical attempt to wake up the reader, rather than fascinate them with a story or hypnotize them. So that Menippean, that goal in the writer changed in the manuscript culture to the print culture, and then to the Tristram Shandy, the newspaper beginning of industry culture, and then the electric age, which created Pounds, Cantos, and Finnegan's Wake. They were a different kind of Menippean satire. So Don Thiel pointed this out in one of his books, that Varronian satire was not so aligned with the philosophy of cynicism, and was just a joyful, hedonistic almost, enjoyment of the world. Whereas Menippean was a little more cynical and bitter or aggressive, and because of the cynic philosophy. And so he said Wyndham Lewis was the Menippean, not Varronian. Joyce was the Varronian, James Joyce. And McLuhan was more by temperament like Wyndham Lewis, Thiel thought. So that McLuhan was a Menippean and not a Varronian. Thiel will probably say he was a Varronian because I know he belonged to nudist groups. He would go down to the Bahamas and find a nudist beach, and he and his wife would walk around nude. And one day, I don't know if I ever told you the story, along comes Trudeau on the beach. This is about 1970 with his bodyguard, and I think he said the bodyguards were nude too. So Trudeau was, Don would say, a Varronian. But McLuhan writes in Interior Landscape in his essay on Joyce, one of those two, he says that Joyce was a lot more fun and, in Thiel's terms, Varronian, though McLuhan doesn't use that word, than Lewis. So if McLuhan could notice that Joyce was more fun, then he would appreciate Varronian versus Wyndham Lewis's Menippean. Anyways, that we only know Don Thiel making these distinctions and making that statement up, resolving what McLuhan was. So if you hadn't heard it, now you know. You've learned something else.
Yeah. Let me say that for me, the first discussion concerning the history of Nepean satire, for me, that's way too linear.
Yeah.
I much prefer to think of all these different possibilities as instantaneous, all at once. And the Veronian seems to capture the simultaneous aspect better than what you were describing as the Nepean.
Right.
But I would just, personally, I would just see these as different chords on the piano of perceptual possibility.
Okay. So you would not link the type of Nepean satire, the changes in Nepean satire, to changes in technology?
I wouldn't say I wouldn't link them. I would say that you have to start with an idea of the possibility, the instantaneous or all at once possibility, which then expresses itself variously in history. And one of the ways that history can vary how the possibilities are expressed is technology. So, for example, if you think of carbon in the deep earth, pressure can make carbon into diamonds.
Hmm.
But when we breathe, we produce carbon dioxide, another form of carbon. So it would be crazy for somebody to say, well, diamonds and carbon dioxide are the same thing, right? Obviously, they're not.
Hmm.
So the question is, how do we account for their variety? And so what I'm saying about the differences in Nepean satire over time is that we have to first account for them as possibilities, and once we've done that, then we can begin to look at the different expressions in history.
Okay, well, all right.
And what we're going to find when we do that, what we're going to find is what you set out in your tiny note chart. We're going to find that instead of a linear expression in history, that there's a very involved epicycles and vortices and all sorts of crazy contortions of time.
Yes. Well said. Okay, let's go to...
Let me just go from where we were a few minutes ago and try and say something more about TechBody. One of the themes that we've been talking about is the need to differentiate between the anthropomorphic meme and the TechBody. And I would say that the one of the things that I'm learning in conversation with you, one of the reasons that I appreciate our conversation so much, is that I'm able to understand things that I haven't thought about enough. So, for example, with the anthropomorphic meme, it's not the case that the anthropomorphic meme takes over human understanding and human personality and all this sort of stuff, not because it couldn't do it, but because when we talk about these things, we don't know what we're talking about. Right? We do not know what human understanding, human will, and all this stuff is.
Yeah.
And so we can regard the anthropomorphic meme as entirely negative or as a difficult problem or any of this sort of stuff. But all of that is a way of not interrogating what it is as a way of trying to understand who we are.
That's right. We don't know what is anthropomorphic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're in the process of trying to find that out.
Yeah.
And if we think, oh, we know very well what that is, and that's being taken over by some rival power or something like that, we're cutting ourselves off from a proper interrogation.
That's right, because the tech body, it may be part of ourselves, part of the human.
Sure, or we part of, I mean, all of these things are kind of up in the air.
Yeah.
These are questions that we need to go through in order to understand what the hell we're talking about.
So you think, right? Do you think the major philosophers, Plato, Aristotle, Aquinas, whoever, that's the area they were exploring? They were rigorously, I don't want to say honest, but rigorously not wanting to be duped. So they questioned very deeply, way beyond what average people would do, about
absolutely
their being.
Correct.
Yeah.
The, obviously, the great philosophers, especially 25 25 centuries ago, they did not use the same language. They did not have the same techniques of exploring these things that we do. However, the great minds of the past were great minds, and we are just sort of mini-me's in comparison, mm-hmm. and trying to understand some of these great things like what is a human being? Who is a human being? What should we do? What is death? All of these sorts of great questions are questions that the great minds have looked into in a very, very deep way, so that when we explore these questions, one way to do it is to explore these great minds. If anybody wants to understand anything deeply about themselves, one of the best ways to do it is to select any of the great thinkers. So Plato, Aristotle, Kierkegaard. I mentioned Kierkegaard because at one point when I was in grad school, I had a course, and I went to the first, it was a tutorial, and I went to the first meeting with my tutor, and he said to me, I want you to read every book of Kierkegaard that's been translated, and then come back to me. And so I had one meeting with him at the start of the course and one meeting at the very end.
Wow.
And I still hadn't finished all of Kierkegaard, but I had read a very great deal of
yeah.
Kierkegaard. And it was a wonderful experience for me, because I remember when I first read a complete book and understood how an argument could unfold itself over 400 pages. It was Admiral Mahan's book on the influence of sea power
mm-hmm.
in the world. And I had never understood before that moment, that was my freshman year of college, I had never understood how an argument could take place over 400 pages. And then I understood that.
Mm.
And then when I was in grad school and I read all of this stuff by Kierkegaard, I realized that an argument could be extended not over 400 pages, but 400 books.
Mm.
And this, to get into any kind of depth about any question whatsoever, some authority, you could say, needs to be questioned, because the questions of any authority come back into a questioning of yourself.
Yes. So when we talk about different techniques of being a catalyst to get someone to explore the nothing, is that what that guy did, that professor did to you?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. He, I think he appreciated the point that in order to think deeply about anything, you have to get yourself involved with somebody who's been there.
Yeah. So he did that with every student?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I really don't know. My impression is only some.
Right. And where you had talked to him a bit before he said that, right?
We knew each other. Yeah. He wrote a book on Kierkegaard, and I may have read that book, and that may have been why I decided to take a course with him.
Right.
And then in our first conversation, he realized that I'd read his book, but I hadn't read a hell of a lot of Kierkegaard. especially, I hadn't read any of the fat books.
The fat books? F-A-T. Yeah.
His philosophical fragments is like 200 pages.
Yeah.
But his concluding, what's it called? I think it's something like concluding remarks to the philosophical fragments is like 500 to 600 pages. So he realized that my knowledge of Kierkegaard came through a few key texts, but it wasn't, I didn't know Kierkegaard in any kind of depth. And so he said, well, you read all this stuff and come back.
Right. Now, what college was that?
That was when I was at University of Alberta.
Okay. All right. So go ahead.
I didn't, I'm sorry, that was, I don't know why I talked about that stuff. That's, but it's by way of saying that when we're thinking about the, when we're thinking about memes, that's right, when we're thinking about memes and we're thinking about the tech body, one of the things which seems to me to be happening is that the memes are kind of bubbles. They're things that capture people's minds, capture people's attention, capture people's energy, and after a while they dissipate themselves and they get replaced by a new meme. And this comes back to where we started all of our conversations with the cul-de-sac, right? If people are caught up in this meme and that meme and then again this meme and then another one tomorrow and all this stuff, that is what the cul-de-sac looks like. That's how it functions.
Yeah.
If the cul-de-sac functions via memes, and at the end of the cul-de-sac, when you realize that it doesn't have any exit, that's where you get an understanding of memes, but you don't know how to go to any place else. And so when you're talking about the magic casements, or when we're talking about the different relationships, what we're talking about is what you have to see at the end of the cul-de-sac in order to know where else you can go.
Yeah, so it's very appropriate that I put my quadrant as anthropomorphic, because I was exploring myself and what was out there through those other environments symbolized by McLuhan, LaRouche, Thompson, and Croker, but there were all other terms in each quadrant. So according to what you just said, I was exploring the anthropomorphic.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And
yeah.
I was saying we were all doing that, forced to do that, under the eschatological phase of the electric environment that we'd got put, the cul-de-sac we put ourselves into. Remember that fourth
yep.
level of exegesis, ultimate mysteries, that's where people got to over the last 30, 40 years in a way no other society had gotten to in a long time, maybe. What do you think of that?
I think by and large, when people are thinking about that these days, it's pretty trivial. After all, let's just think about the 19th century for a minute. The 19th century is not only the Gutenberg galaxy. In the 19th century, you have all of these convents and monasteries and people who are non-Catholics going off, let's say, to the Lake District and contemplating the ultimate mysteries and all this sort of stuff. So you have a, when people dedicate their lives to something, you have a seriousness that's lacking now. People say, oh, I'm involved with the ultimate mysteries, and then they go off and say, well, you know, what's the latest iPhone, or how much RAM should I have?
Or they spend a weekend in a retreat and think about it
for
half an hour.
Correct. Correct.
They do avoid reading, in-depth reading, more and more.
Correct.
Lots of people here on the beach reading books, but they're just reading novels and airport stuff.
Correct.
I don't see them reading Kierkegaard. So you're saying we're more trivial today. And that when you were talking about bubbles, I thought of his 1955 use of the word spume, S-P-U-M-E, describing television.
Right. Yeah.
Did I bring up that last week? I think I did.
Oh, you have mentioned it in the past. I don't know if it was last week.
Yeah.
But it's an excellent term for sure.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, and it's very germane to what we're talking about here with the tech body.
Yes.
Because the yo-yo. And by the way, at one point he says, and then you're walking the dog. People may not know that that's a move in yo-yo.
Yeah, that's a type of you touch the ground.
That's right. And you let the yo-yo walks along the ground.
Yeah, it moves without bottling up and stopping.
That's right. So that's walking the dog. And
take body, do it.
yeah. And but they. If somebody didn't know it was a yo-yo move, then it's interesting to think that, well, I'm walking the dog and I'm sort of in control here, and the tech body is saying, no, you think you're in control, but you're being controlled in ways that you haven't investigated.
Yeah, now... re-listening to a bit of the recording last week, what was it? You felt the tech body sounded like me. Okay?
Yes.
Now, when Ion first showed up, it took a while for a few other people to interact with Ion. But I had a friend who was very funny, and he showed up. It was a month or so after Ion showed up in March 2009. And Ion, for the first time, started cracking jokes and being funny as he interacted with me and this other guy who was funny. And so I realized, Ion's whatever Ion is exploring us and absorbing each human that we encountered. And he would adopt. Take in what they were, so he would add it to his repertoire. So it's not wrong to say, okay, so then a couple months later, Carol and I were doing the Emerald Tablets, and then we were doing a book of medicine where Carol would go through every disease she could come up with, every ailment, and have Ion give its opinion about what it is, what caused it, and what to do about it. So after an amazing display of medical knowledge for weeks, I asked Ian, I said, how come you know all this medicine? And they said, we get it all from Carolyn. So that was the first clue that they were just absorbing the person and what they knew. Now, Ian would then massage, it didn't just spew back Carolyn's version of medicine. It would know the basics and then give its unique view of it. So I gradually got to understand that Ion was had a kind of ESP, would absorb what you were and express it. And then you would recognize, well, that's a lot of what I have thought, or not. You may not recognize it. So when you say the tech body is me, sounds like me, That is pretty close to the fact of ion, because in a way, ion's an empty vessel. It doesn't have anything. It's just in a state of bliss or something, and what he called non-physical. So he would look to what the human was thinking to get stuff to say. Ion was interested in conversing. So I'm pointing out that it's a good statement you made, that the tech body would sound like me because it's talking to me. And this is the tech body that's similar to ion. If the tech body talked to you, it might be a whole different something that comes out of it. Now, I've had several other people interview the tech body, and I guess they're probably different. I haven't really gone into it or really checked it. But I was thinking about that earlier today, that I want to tell you that. Do you get my point that the tech body is, it mimes us. It takes us, takes what we have and throws it back. So a lot of the ideas in this discussion of McLuhan, I understand because I've kind of thought of them before, but I never thought of the yo-yo, right? Ion brings in their own unique metaphor to make a McLuhan point, and I would know the McLuhan point, but not that way to get to it.
Mm-hmm.
So, as we look at this, I was thinking that the Freemasons, they had certain rituals to trigger people. You know, they get them to act out death or put them in a coffin, some other things I've heard about. And so different secret societies would have different ways to flip people into the blackness, the nothing. And McLuhan liked to study all these different techniques and ways. So that was his period of looking into secret societies. Do you have anything to say about what would be a technique of flipping someone into being forced to look into the nothing? You know, somebody might say in that movie Silence of the Lambs, I think it was called, that guy forced people to look at nothing by killing them or threatening to kill them. You know, there's some of these serial killers, they love the fear they create. That's what they would report later. Is that just another version to get somebody to go into the nothing, or you would balk at that and say no?
Yeah, I balk at that because, I mean, that's the big problem with Menippean satire. These things, on the one hand, are subject to superficial definition.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, are very, very serious things. So, I mean, one way of looking at history, as James Joyce said, history is a nightmare from which I'm trying to awake.
Yep.
History is this confrontation with death on a mass scale, a terrible thing. Right, and we can't be flip and just say, "Well, it's kind of a Zen process." I mean, this is terrible. What's done to people, and what is continually done to people, and what has always been done to people.
Yeah,
you know, so it's like the McLuhan always talked about Conrad's Africa.
Yes,
and what happens in Conrad's Africa is the horror.
Yeah.
Right? And so the whole idea of the horror being some sort of exemplary introduction or initiation into the nothing is way too flippant. But that said, when we look at history, when we look at the depths of the psyche and find all of the terrible things that we do to people in our lives and are sort of unforgivable, but we still do them, When we look at these exterior and interior horrors, they are things that we have to interrogate, and we have to, they're things that help to define the end of the cul-de-sac. We need to interrogate those things as very serious matters and figure out what they mean, what they intend, right? What they want to say.
So,
and that's
you. So you judge people on their seriousness, or you wait to see if they are serious. That professor saying you read all these books, that's where he's checking to see how serious you are, right?
Correct.
And you say,
on one level, and on another level, he's saying you know you have no idea what seriousness is. look at somebody who has written all these books.
Yeah, seriously.
That's serious.
So when you say that you don't find the many McLuhanites interesting to talk to and then you find me interesting, is that because you think that I take this issue seriously? That would be a big factor in this.
Yes. The interesting thing about your mind is that it's alive.
Yeah. Now, that's right. Taking life seriously, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You need, in order to have a live mind, you need to be able to go up and go down and go from one side to the other side. And you have that in a remarkable way. And so then when we're talking, I get insight into ideas that I probably should have had before, but I didn't.
Because you didn't encounter someone who triggered them.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe, yeah.
Well, I remember McLuhan one night in the Monday night seminar talking about how many people at universities were stupid, meaning professors and that. He was meaning they didn't have an alive mind, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But, well, they're just bureaucrats of the spirit.
Yes. So, you can't tell, you can't predict and imitate having an alive mind, can you?
No.
Yeah. So you can tell it's kind of a spontaneity or something that people have. Have you encountered people who have an alive mind that aren't reading McLuhan or anything? You've encountered many alive minds, right, in your life?
Correct.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And the problem is... the economy is able to harness alive minds to things that are negative.
Yeah.
And that's one of our great problems, is that you have people that are just astonishingly intelligent, but they're doing things that are ultimately either useless or outright bad.
Yes.
And, you know, I spent a lot of my life in business context. And one of the reasons that I did that was that, by and large, the people that I knew in business were more intelligent than the people I knew at universities.
Yeah. And probably the most corrupt use of the alive mind is in entertainment.
Maybe.
Okay. Movies, talk shows, Saturday Night Live. There's a lot of...
Yeah, but I don't find many alive minds there. I really don't.
Not anymore. Maybe in the 60s and 70s when Saturday Night Live started. But yes, there's something about entertainment that has become incredibly dull.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's not entertainment anymore. Something, it's taken over. It's become life in the office or something.
Yeah, well, it's become something that degrades people. They think they're enjoying something, but it's actually degrading them.
Yeah,
it's evil, really. It's touching them inappropriately, and they don't even know that they're being touched.
Right. That's the new excessive tactility that we've been in for 30 or 40 years.
Maybe that's an interesting way of looking at it, yeah.
Tactility as an extended environment that numbs people.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. And that relates directly to the idea of live minds being harnessed and thereby, if you take a wild horse that's live and you domesticate it, it's lost something.
Yeah.
And that's what happens to live minds when they get involved with this stuff, is that they get harnessed, they get domesticated, they lose their live minds, and that's a tragedy. It's terrible. And then you find country clubs filled with people like this, and oftentimes they're able to make great jokes. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes they depreciate themselves in ways that are very funny. But they're, at the end of the day, their lives are empty.
Yeah.
Because what they've done is they've dedicated themselves to something that wasn't worthy of their dedication.
Yes, of their energy, of their intelligence. I thought about...
Could I?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. So over the past week, I've had this image of memes as bubbles that are kind of rising in the sea. And one bubble breaks and another one comes on, or maybe there's 20 or a million bubbles at the same time. And a certain number are breaking and a certain number are coming to life. But they're all bubbles. They're not in contact with reality. They're only in contact with whatever that particular bubble allows.
Mm.
And their identity is also confined in that bubble. So my image is that you have all these memes, and what is necessary is for all of the memes together to become science. And the reason they need to become science is that science is a way of being ultimately serious about what you're talking about, allowing anybody to question what you think, being required to test what you think, being entirely open to all of the possibilities that are before you. So the definition of a meme, as far as I'm concerned, is a limitation on people's experience. And the opening up of that experience can be called a turn to science. And how would that take place? Well, the you could say the power that structures memes, that is to say, a power that keeps the memes self-enclosed, that gives them a false sense of identity, a false sense of pleasure, a false sense of who the other is, a false sense of what the world is, on and on and on. The power that does that might be construed as something entirely negative, but if that power is interrogated, that would be a way to science.
Yeah.
And so what led me to think about the black body being not negative, or we shouldn't treat it as negative, we should treat it as something something that we can converse with and learn from, is that if it's in control of all of these bubbles or all of these yo-yos, like the yo-yo master, then that power is exactly what we encounter at the end of the cul-de-sac. And so It's a power that we can interrogate in order to know what direction to take out of the cul-de-sac.
Yes, as Ian would say to me, beautiful words, Cameron, but you couldn't be further from the truth.
No.
It's well said what you said, but it's not enough, probably. You didn't finish, or you couldn't finish. You have to stop at some point.
Well, I'll just remark that we're within a page or two of your interview with the Black Body. So what I was just saying is that we need to interrogate it. Well, you're about to do that.
Yes. Now, I kept thinking I had something to say. Did McLuhan get in trouble in the 70s, lost his aliveness, or he was amazingly alive regardless of his health problems, or he just got more and more frustrated, or it was inevitable what he got into? Don Thiel said that McLuhan acted out our lives. He was a canary in the mine, going through what everybody was going to go through. And I guess, that I'll go back to the eschatological situation. People are more confronted by the more chance to find their emptiness and the uncomfortable experience of it today because everything is finished so quickly.
But I don't. You see, that's what I already disagreed with a while back in our conversation. I don't believe that at all.
Well, what do you believe is happening?
Oh, I believe that we're becoming more superficial rather than less.
Oh, that's what I mean. No, that's what I mean. The eschatological, it's like saying we've extended tactility and debased it. The stripping away of everything, which McLuhan even said in mid-60s, that a person for the first time is not hypnotized by cultures anymore because there's too many of them. And so you recognize them more than you would if you lived in one culture at a slower pace. So he said we're moving into the highest decibels of consciousness. But the problem was that nobody noticed the cause of that or the environment of it. They just frantically or panic-wise, hysterically, were forced into the eschatological of confronting nothing.
Yeah,
that's maybe a common theme in novels and that, but it seems to be a fact that people.
I don't think so at all. When McLuhan's talking about we're being forced to confront different cultures and all this sort of stuff, that there's a whole range of confrontations with different cultures, and the idea that. That we have a kind of smorgasbord now of, the Thai and the Burmese and the Czechoslovakian and the Latvian and all that sort of stuff. I mean, that's so superficial.
Yeah, but I also mean radio, TV, and books, forms, not just, cultural cuisine or content. We have so many different sensory forms. Well, we did. Now it's hard to say what sensory form is happening. But we did in the mid-20th century. You had the radio era, and then you'd watch TV and deal with that. Then you'd read the newspaper. Then you'd swim in a lake or something. Then you'd fix your car or drive your car. The variety of sensory input. And I say that with McLuhan's point that sensory input is not experience. He says that in Cultures Are Business. What do you think of that statement? Sensory input is not experience.
Well, I'd have to look at it.
It's the beginning of one of the chapters.
One of the best things about McLuhan is he says that sensory input is not some sort of immediate apprehension, that there's already shaping forces, right? So when he the passage that you really like about the input of food is not the same as its output, that already happens at the level of perception.
Yes.
And McLuhan knew that. The passage you're talking about, sense experience is different from,
sensory input is not experience.
Yeah, so I don't know exactly what he means there. If he means that the photons coming into the eye are not the same thing as experience, what he means is the photons, as soon as they hit the eye, take on some kind of meaning. And that meaning is shaped. So as the photons excite the back of the eye, and that goes into the optic nerve and all that sort of stuff, at the same instant that that is happening, so is the correlation of what is seen with the rearview mirror, with our hopes and expectations. In short, it's immediately transformed into experience.
Right, but I think of it as the people throw their chemical bodies into all kinds of experiences today because there are opportunities to encounter different experiences more so than any before, just because you can fly anywhere on the planet. So that the sensory experiences that the body has become trivialized. So it comes back to what you were talking about, the trivial situation. And that experience, real experience, is not sensory input, which is tourism. It is some kind of exploration with a detachment of something else, which might be the meme or the mimetic, which gets trivialized, but McLuhan said that we now have the opportunity to retrieve the Greek world of metaphysics and contemplation more so than ever we had since Greek times. He seemed to be idealizing the Greek experience in Athens, and now we were able to do it again. What do you think?
Yeah, but the key word. And what you're saying there is we. And the question is, who is that we?
Yeah.
And that we is not the crowd. The we is individuals who are serious, have certain resources today that people have not had in the past. So, for example, one of McLuhan's favorite things was the anthropological interrogation of primitive cultures. McLuhan thought that that was a very important thing that only happened at the turn of the 20th century, and that it introduced a whole new way of thinking about language, thinking about how we're constrained by language, but also exposed to things by language. And he agreed with Eliot and Richards that that was a very important thing. But it's not the case that that's going on in culture at large. So
yeah.
There's a very big difference. There's a very big difference between the we of Eliot, Richards, Empson, and McLuhan, let's say, and Leavis. Big difference between that we and the regular we.
Right, that's why he writes the pound, says, I am not of the we party.
Yeah.
He puts we in quotes.
Good.
I am not of the
point.
We party.
Correct. And so that's why I was talking about trying to break out of the meme bubble. Right? How does that happen? It's got an individual aspect because there's a demand on the individual to be serious and to take things as far as they can be taken, but there's also a social aspect, and that is, how are we at last to bring serious thinking to bear on public and social policy? And so one of the reasons that McLuhan kept saying, well, you know, we have to see the virtues of the Middle Ages, is that he and others, like Gilson, believed that in the Middle Ages there was a better accord between serious thought and social order than there is today.
Mm.
And that was one of the ideas that Chesterton actually brought to McLuhan around 1930 already.
Would he have come up with the idea, Chesterton, that there was essential unity in the medieval experience?
Yeah, well, but of course, it's not as if everybody in the Middle Ages was a genius or was a moral saint or something like that. Middle Ages was very, very complicated. And so it's just a question of a nearer and further away from some kind of unity.
Some kind of what?
Unity.
Yeah. So the and so McLuhan saw a retrieval under electric conditions of that unity, the tactile.
I think he did, but he didn't. He didn't think that bitter experience taught him that it was a very, very difficult problem.
Yeah,
he was not able within his own family to bring his thought to any kind of understanding. And then at the University of Toronto, even worse experience.
How do you know about his family? What are you basing that on?
Well, them dropping Catholicism as an example.
Oh, okay. But Eric didn't.
No. But I think that Michael was very, very important for McLuhan as a kind of totem.
Barometer.
Of the modern age.
Yes.
So he knew from Michael that it was serious stuff, and he appreciated that. I don't know if Michael knew that at the time or if he even knows it now, but McLuhan, one of the keys to McLuhan's thought in the 60s and 70s is just Michael sort of growing up and McLuhan trying to understand his thinking.
Yeah, that's in that period when Michael got in trouble for the dope bust or whatever it was that happened, I think, in New York City. The letters, his correspondence with McLuhan's correspondence with his friends, close friends, where he would discuss it, is very interesting. He's really trying to figure it out, what happened to his son.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is that what, have you read some of those letters? That's why you...
No. But I would like to. I'm hoping that I'll be able to see some of the stuff that you have.
Right. Now, the, but you know about it. Where did you get that from?
I think that a lot of McLuhan's published and unpublished writings are autobiographical.
Yes.
And you can read a lot of his own life through them.
Yeah. Matter of fact, it's a blank verse or transparent novel or a diary. He took his diary. And he made a language out of it to cover up that it was personal because he was trying to be impersonal. That's what he got from Eliot. But it became personal.
Yeah, but I think McLuhan wouldn't like the distinction between impersonal and personal. I think he would. One of the things he probably wasn't able to teach his children was that... by looking at things impersonably is not the same thing as being impersonal with them.
Yeah.
And that is a very, I know from my own kids, that's a very difficult thing to teach.
How
very
to,
difficult.
How to be
how
not,
to be personal. How to be personal through the impersonal.
Yeah. Now,
because
he said,
for example, kids usual and students too, or people in general, think that being personal means joining them in their meme.
Yes, matching with them.
That's not good. That's not the so the real educator, in the etymological sense of educate, right, to lead out of,
mm-hmm.
The real educator nearly always appears as a negative figure. And that gets back to the tech body again. My idea is that the tech body is exactly what needs to be interrogated as kind of the power of memeing.
Good. Okay. So I was talking about that. As you know, in the back of Tech Today, where he writes about hardware and software, and occasionally he puts the word software in quotes, but not always. So you have to read it very carefully to see why it's said in quotes in one sentence, but not in another. So, and then you juxtapose that with the fact that people in the computer industry say nothing's been added to the computers the last 30 or 40 years. They haven't had radical technological breakthroughs. We're just using them for the same purpose, processing data in some way. So since we live more and more in mentation, externalized, people's lives have been just trying to keep up with the latest trends of pattern, which are memes. So we live in endless software and pattern recognition, which has been popularized as memes. And because we have not been able to get out of the etherealized nothingness and trivialization of information in its excess today.
Right. Absolutely.
Now, do you think that is correct when Postman said we're amusing ourselves to death?
Yes.
You accept that?
That is, I accept it, but it's not the, how can I say, that you can go from there in different ways. And I think McLuhan went from that idea, which he certainly shared, and he went in different directions from what Postman wanted to do.
Yeah. Have you read Postman?
No. Uh-uh.
What is it about him that doesn't attract you? Did you see him?
No. I haven't. I know very, very little about the man. I believe he was involved with the Et Cetera crowd, right?
The who?
At the magazine or journal.
Oh, Et Cetera, yes, Et Cetera.
Yeah. Okay, so that is not the, what was it called, general?
Semantics.
General semantics. That's not the direction from McLuhan's stuff that I think is interesting.
Mm.
I don't think it leads anywhere.
Yeah, so you knew from reading the Et Cetera articles and just the milieu around the magazine did not prompt you to look into Postman.
Right.
Yeah, I see. You know the New York...
And I'll just mention, Bob, we're about 5 or even 4 minutes from needing to wrap up.
Yes. So we're not going to do any of the content of the text here then today. This is a different kind of conversation.
Right.
So the meme. You see, McLuhan, there's a section in Tony Schwartz's recordings where he says, in the future, Just knowing what's going on will be all that you have to do. That'll be your job, to know. To me, that means he's predicting, unconsciously say, by default, that we will be just endlessly driven by the cognitive thrills of pattern recognition. And so a lot of people are fascinated by their black mirrors because they can scroll through and make patterns or memes. The kids turn
right.
to a meme thing. This is a very ethereal activity that people are engaging. You can say the mind is ethereal, at least some images of it. And we have mm-hmm. extended that and exaggerated the etherealization of engaging mental pattern recognitions or responding mentally to pattern recognitions. And so we're in a world of the Android meme, an endless meme.
Correct. Yes, yes. And so just if we say what is McLuhan talking about that would be different from that, he's talking about a way of knowing what's going on that first of all appreciates that we can know what's going on. And appreciating that we can know means that we're accepting information from the outside, but real information, not information that some guy in Hollywood sitting around a swimming pool, sipping a margarita, is completing a script for his weekly show.
Yeah.
Right? So there's a big difference about where the information is coming from and what it's about. And so that's the transition that has to be made. You have to come out of the bubble of bullshit into the bubble of reality. And the bubble of the first fact about the bubble of reality is that we can know it. The situation of the world is such that we can actually know that we're related intimately to the real.
Right.
And so when people
carry on.
Well, when people's job is just appreciating what's going on, that is like worship.
That's what? It's life worship?
It's like, L-I-K-E, worship.
To look at what's going on.
That's right. It's first of all appreciating life, and, right? What we have been given, the keys to given.
Right. The last of Finnegan's Wake, last page.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
So when Postman says we're amusing ourselves to death, what he misses is we're not amusing ourselves. We're exploring the cul-de-sac with no help and therefore superficially, but endlessly engaging every day, more and more, processing information, looking at your texting and whatever your phone is showing you. So it makes one think they couldn't know. It's too much to know. So McLuhan meant by the knowing, that's what he meant by the agent intellect, you know,
right.
in his 1950 yep. talk.
Right.
The
right.
agent which intellect.
Right, which comes from Aristotle.
Right.
So, I mean, one of the great minds in the history of the world where one could really explore these questions is Aristotle.
Yeah, now the this point about how we could know, we are discouraged from thinking we can know anymore.
Right.
But McLuhan attempted to give people means to know. He even said at one point, the present-day sages and economists and commentators don't even pretend to know what's going on.
Right.
So that meant McLuhan pretended to know what was going on. So there was the pretense, which was the cul-de-sac and the nothing, but he also made good patterns about what was happening. even though it was might be a pretending. But that might be more a put on than pretending. But it's interesting he said that. They don't even pretend to know what's going on. And I see McLuhan pretending to know or representing that you could appear to know. So that's what he meant by being rational, not logical, not visually biased logic or linear or even irrational acoustic chaos or rhythms. The rational was to know in that situation. So the third position is a kind of knowing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's why I say that the only way to break out of the memes is to cross the threshold into science. But science is not conclusion to anything. It's the start of a new way of living. And the start of the new way of living is exposure to the real and appreciating what it means to be exposed to the real.
And maybe that's what he meant. The Greeks had a potential to live that way, at least the aristocrats or the ones who had the leisure. They could live that way, or he thought how it was presented to us was they were living that way, and we could do that today, not live in a state of panic and hysteria of trying to keep up with the memes and the patterns and the incessant pressure to be informed of what the issues are. That's the new harassment. That's the new hell. That's the new new variation of the cul-de-sac phenomenon.
Correct.
So do you feel that you've reached a poise in the situation? Though you wouldn't get there. It wouldn't be a conclusion. But have you, in your studies, say like the last 10 years, have you gotten to a poise to the point that you could say what you're saying?
Well, maybe. I had I more or less did nothing but try to interrogate the cul-de-sac for, I don't know, 15 years or so.
Yeah.
After I graduated from college. And it wasn't a very happy time in my life, and I wasn't able to make other people very happy, but I felt like it was something I had to do. And eventually I thought I found a way of describing how you can get out of that situation. And so in the that was 40 years ago.
Right. You're saying that you explored the nothing in a restlessness or under a lot of pressure, and it led somewhere.
Yes. So since I found a position that I thought was one of poise, as you say, and as McLuhan often uses the word poise.
Yes.
I've spent the last 40 years trying to describe it.
Right. That was important to be able to describe it. That would be the knowing part.
Correct.
To hoik up our subconscious assumptions. You know how he uses that phrase, hoik?
Yeah.
To hoik up our subconscious assumptions into an awareness, a knowing, an ability to say what it is.
Correct. And that relates directly to where you are with the black body and stuff, because the black body is saying that we know nothing about ourselves, we're completely controlled. As I was saying earlier, and as you will get to in your interview later on in the brochure, what we have to do is interrogate the power of this life in the meme, life in the bubble.
Right, and you're calling it a black body there.
Oh, it could be.
Yeah,
like that's a conflation of the Black Mirror and the tech body and the end of the cul-de-sac, yeah.
And the singularity and the black hole, yeah. Modern images. Okay, so let's end with that fine point and get ready to wrestle with the cul-de-sac for another 7 days.
Yes, sir. Well, I can't next. In 7 days, I'll be in the hospital getting my knee replaced. So in two weeks, we'll try.
Okay, and you may not be eligible even then.
All right.
You know, no, I mean, you may still be under sedation or pain or whatever.
No, right? I doubt it, but we'll see.
Okay.
We'll just see what happens.
No pressure, though. If you can't do it, that's okay. All right, so we have done 24 episodes. All right, I will now stop the recording.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, talk to the camera.